Hello, 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 people. Welcome back to another episode of the USL Show. We are back, and so is professional U.S. soccer. And listen, the USL has been hot in the streets. It has been the talk of the town, not that the town. We might get to that later. We'll keep you hanging. Hey, lots of good stuff to talk about. I'm going to go ahead and shut my yapping. Phil, how you doing?
I'm good. Yeah, it was a quietly optimistic, you know, as you can be in a loss. So feeling pretty decent after week one, and lucky for me, you know, we get to jump right into a midweek game too. So, you know, it's just nonstop action down in El Paso to start the season.
As is always, John, how are you doing?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just back in it. Like, there was absolutely no lag. I've just given my life back over to the USL, and I'm loving it.
As always. Ryan?
I'm doing well. It may have been a good thing that we didn't post the screenshot of our predictions last week because it was a challenging week for us all. And it's probably a good thing I don't have NC sports betting as of this past week, and it started here on Monday. On the bright side, though, I went 12-1 of my Oscar predictions, which is what really counts here.
Truly, what the only thing that matters. Before we go too far, I want to thank our patrons: John Hunt, Frank Anthony, Aaron J, Christopher Cohn, Harry Austin, John Fuller, Michael Fuchs, Joshua Deuter, and Noah Telford. Thank you all so much for supporting what we do. I mentioned the last time, but all of your donations for this upcoming month will also be sent to Backyard Footy. So thank you so much for not just helping us, but helping the wider community as a whole. And for those Charlotte people, we are going to be talking about you later. Just a little quick administration side, just to kind of hit this high and tight. Santa Barbara's back. They announced that they will not be kicking off the 2024 season after 2024 season has kicked off, and I appreciate that. Thank you.
Oh, they
they released a statement today saying that they're not going to play in 2024, which, I mean, hey, Fuego, like, signed multiple players on the day they kicked off, so anything is possible, but we kind of knew.
Now, see, I love what Gio said, and he was like, he said the dream of the WWF intro of just Santa Barbara's here, actually, the dream's dead, which kind of here for it.
I would kill for that. Like, they release a statement mid-season that, hey, we're not going to be ready for 2025 either, and then they just show up for the first game.
They never show up for the title game and cash in their money in the bank briefcase.
What if they just randomly joined the USL League One Challenge Cup?
When we had, I think, wasn't there an NASL team who joined like halfway through the season?
Well, because the NASL had the spring and fall leagues, and you could win one and qualify for the playoffs that would happen in October, and it was stupid and dumb. So at least like there were separate leagues.
Right.
It's fine. Everything's fine. Are we calling? I don't know what it's called. I think it was just like
League One in season cup because they don't have a sponsor yet.
Right.
It's us.
We're sponsored by the NBA.
The USL Show Cup.
USL League One USL Show Cup.
Brought to you by random TV provider that you never heard of.
Brought to you by Lockheed Martin. Brought to you by Boeing.
Oh, Jesus.
This anyway. League is falling apart.
No, we're not that down bad. USL League One was actually in good form this weekend. So,
well, so are PR statements from Boeing. So, let's move on. Let's talk about like what there was this week, and I just want to go ahead open it up with CBS Galazzo. My word, the broadcast! That broadcast quality is what we're getting every single week. Oh,
it's like such a necessary level up, I think. And I know that Vista obviously is the production company that handles all of the broadcasts, and they have an immense job in terms of turning out like all of these different locations, different local crews, you know, some remote broadcast crews. They have like a big job on their hands. And like, there was just a clear delineation, it felt like, between the ESPN broadcast, just in the quality and graphics and all of that was just like leveled up significantly on CBS. And Charleston, North Carolina, although it was a little bit of a cagey game in the end and not maybe, you know, the big blockbuster that everybody was hoping for in terms of like the debut on CBS, from a quality standpoint, like not a single technical issue in sight, like graphics were great. The picture quality was lovely. And that's on a free broadcast that anyone can get to. And that is just like what USL, you know, in terms of adverts for the league, like that is just such a big level up for the league in, yeah, hopefully getting some new eyes on it.
And like the comments even mentioned as well, like we still ran into problems off the ESPN Plus broadcast from this season, just comparatively for the start. I think it was the New Mexico Pittsburgh game had the Memphis Las Vegas audio to it as well, which just by comparison, CBS Golazo just had a sharper image. They had just like no technical issues, like you'd mentioned, Phil. And it's just a fantastic showing for what CBS can provide part of their deal versus what we've been used to with ESPN Plus, which still ESPN Plus is fantastic to have just for all the different options across Championship and League One. But CBS Golazo just took it that one step further and just put in a further effort in their broadcasts.
Yeah, and the way that you got the Ben Pierman interview on the morning, I think it was on Morning Footy, maybe last Friday, yes. The way that they had a couple highlight breakdown type things on the Twitter account for the USL on the same feed where you're getting Serie A, Champions League, that's good for the brand. And the broadcast quality, as everyone has been saying, was really good. The commentary, to me, it was a mix of maybe people who were less familiar with the USL and some color commentators who are familiar voices if you've been on the ESPN Plus streams for a couple of years. So yeah, all in all, really good. Excited to see where things go as the CBS team like gets more familiar with the product that they're putting out, as they start to ramp up that content a little bit. And as we build to that Louisville Indianapolis proximity association football match on proper CBS.
It's only fitting that the oldest rivalry in the world is the first one on CBS.
Really, just
so here's the thing with me, and this is the one thing I talk about a lot. The camera quality that CBS does, and this is not just for the USL, this is across all their sporting broadcasts. CBS found the balance between good cameras while not being better than the products that are out there. If you've ever watched a Fox sporting event, they invest in like 8K cameras and it looks horrible on TV because the TVs are just simply not good enough. In a couple of years, when most TVs are caught up to the camera qualities, it's going to look stunning. But CBS toes the line of great camera quality and most TVs can handle it. And I think that really leads to CBS having just a really nice product. Also, like the new Scorebug, I have one problem with it. One singular problem. I guess that one too. That was an issue. The dash. The dash is weird.
Yes. We don't need yes. Yes.
I hate it. Especially since half the teams are wearing black. You only get half of a dash. It's weird.
Well, and with
somebody else is noting this. Yeah.
With the split color of the Scorebug, you don't need the dash. Like,
yeah.
Like everybody can tell the difference.
Yeah. Like it's two different colors. Like you don't need the dash in between.
I kept staring at it. I end up looking at the Scorebug because it was bothering me more than it should. I end up looking way too much at it. It was really making me mad.
Overall, though, the graphics package this year does look a little bit sharper, I would say.
For sure. Let's go ahead again to some matches because we still have a lot that we need to cover today. We're going to start off with Phoenix versus Birmingham. John Hunt said, did you see, I'm guessing, Washington
World Soccer Talk
about the production quality. No, I did see that they were talking about football lines, and that's another conversation. We can get to, it's fine.
Would you rather have a stadium with football lines, or would you rather not have a team in your city?
I'm just saying we
baseball field all day.
I mean, I will say Memphis invested in their baseball field turf, and it looked really good.
It did look nice, yeah.
Memphis just looked good overall. Like every single thing Memphis did was outside of the one mistake on the goal. Like I was impressed with 901 in that game. By the way,
Do we have something on that, Taylor? Or
I wonder.
We do. It's crazy how that works. In fact, you get to hear John's voice again, but John from the past. It's
another
crazy.
Year of the USL Tactic Show. We're week by week. We'll be breaking down some sort of key theme from the USL action over the weekend. And today, I want to start with a team that I think was fascinating a lot of people, and that's the Las Vegas Lights. They faced off against Memphis 901 this weekend, and they took an early lead before falling 2-1. The underlying numbers show that Vegas gave up more than 2 expected goals, whereas they only generated 0.4 in their own right. So let's dig into some of the defensive issues that really plagued the Lights on the day. As you can see in this example here, as Memphis builds against the Lights as 4-4-2, there's a real lack of responsibility and reflection within the central midfield. Las Vegas just doesn't have somebody who wants to step up and close down in the central areas, and it hurts them in the end. Memphis is able to get into the final third because they're given so much time to pass their way in. Now, for Las Vegas, there was a bit of an odd issue where Charlie Adams was named to the matchday squad, ultimately didn't get into the game, and that really did play a difference. But as you see here in the second half, even when the Lights move into a new shape, 4-2-3-1, they still lacked the rotation on the weak side to be able to address what Memphis was doing. Constantly, 901 was able to control the ball, work into the central areas, and really pin the Lights back. You've seen one more screenshot from the first half here, where Memphis is getting a touch between 4 midfielders, none of whom show any interest in closing down. It was emblematic of a game where, by contrast, 901 was so much more organized in the press. Now, 901 was building out of a similar 4-4-2 look, but notice how they press in waves. Every move forward is supported by another move behind that to cover space and make sure that 901 isn't ceding room in the most important areas of the pitch. This could be a difference that 901 is returning a lot of players, whereas the Lights are starting off from a blank slate. This means something. 901 may be better than expected, and Las Vegas could take time to get up to speed this year.
Yeah, so with this, I mean, as we all predicted, Vegas gets the first, goal of 2024, as we all knew was going to happen. It started off as a very just interesting match. I sent out a tweet talking about Phil's 30 for 30. How perfect would it be if it just ends with the goal, almost like a Moneyball, where they talk about the winning streak, but we don't talk about what happened after the winning streak. If we just ended the documentary with Vegas scores a goal away from home, and that's just where it cuts to black, was the movie Breakfast Club style, just fists in the air and that's it, like all good. But Memphis came out and they didn't look rattled whatsoever, which was something I was definitely expecting. Was, you score a goal against, or you concede a goal against a team that you think a lot of people think is easily the worst team in the league, and they didn't react. They didn't care. They, got everything back the way they need to. First goal was a bit of a scrappy goal, but they all count the same. And I like what 901's doing. Granted, I liked what 901 was mostly doing. That I think a lot of my thing is they're an Eastern Conference team in the Western Conference that has to play a Western Conference schedule. But if they can get these results early, this could be a fun, fun season for 901.
And this was their first ever win in a season opening match. They had lost their previous 5 games that they had as their first game of the season.
If only somebody had written an article about that.
And flowers for Knight Pickering, who we kind of highlighted in the you know, our preview of Memphis, gets a goal. The fact that he's getting selected, you know, I know he's obviously been around the club for a while. He's not like some new fresh face kid or something like that. He is young still in his career for sure. But he's been around the club now as a full professional for a while. But to continue to get selected when they've brought in the names that they have, like, that is just impressive. And he, you know, shows why the managers put faith in him by putting the ball in the back of the net, which always nice to see a young player like that get off the mark early in the season and kind of get the first one out of the way. And I think he'll be, yeah, a big feature for Memphis this year.
Knight is a key, as another key example of Memphis needing Birmingham to help them get across the line.
It is like an inextricable link at this point.
All of their forwards, like, yeah. That, I mean, Bruno Lapa was basically playing as a second striker, and Marlon, like, that's, yeah, all Birmingham and Memphis.
Two clubs of the same coin, like Arsenal and Chelsea.
Do you have anything on this, John?
Yeah, I mean, I talked about it. Like, Memphis, I really like their press. I think that they're going to be good at keeping the ball on the ground and playing with a tempo that's going to let them adjust to the West well. I thought the fact that they dictated possession was interesting, given that I didn't anticipate that carrying over, given that they had lost Kelly and Malloy. Las Vegas, it's going to be a slow transition. Like, this team came together in January and February. They've not had much time to train with one another. The rotations were slow. No one really had a sense of defensive responsibility. They'll get there because this is a talented squad, but it won't be easy.
Well, let's go ahead and move on from this one because we got a lot of stuff to hit. I want to go over to the defending USL Championship champions, which I think is kind of funny that we have two defending champions in the same league at once. That's just funny to me. But the USL Championship champions, which Phoenix Rising host Birmingham Legion, and Birmingham walks away with 3 points after kind of a bizarre game. If you watched it, it just really weird stuff throughout. But overall, a very entertaining match where neither team looked like they were fully put together yet, but also a lot of talent on display.
Yeah, I mean, I think Phoenix really had a lot of good ideas in build. I thought the way that they were able to activate the Edgar Arrieta, Panos Armanakis pair on the right and in that channel was especially effective for them. Kind of lacking the movement in the box, that final ball to really take advantage of what was often a pretty possession game. And I mean, at the back, that was probably their second unit defensive line, no matter how you slice it. And it did pretty well, honestly, like a couple of big chances. The goal ultimately was unlucky, but it's not like Birmingham wasn't without their opportunities throughout the match. I think the beauty of the early season is you can kind of come away feeling pretty positive about both sides. Like in terms of the process for Phoenix, I'm not worried at all. And then with Birmingham, I know Kaylor will touch on it a little bit more, but I think there was a lot to like from that performance, certainly. And getting 3 points on the road at Phoenix, of course, always a good thing.
Yeah, Go ahead, Ryan.
Oh, I was just going to say the one interesting stat that I took away from this is kind of historically defending champions in their first game following the next season are 6 wins, 2 draws, and 6 losses now when they come into their next game. So it's almost like a kind of 50-50 chance that a team enters the year kind of on a championship hangover. But no, Phoenix shouldn't be overly concerned about this one result, 18 shots from the game. The process is still there and they'll continue to improve.
Yeah, and I think, like John said, I think it's one of those that both teams leave it probably feeling pretty good about how it shook out. Phoenix will, you know, look back at a handful of chances throughout the game and think, we might have made more of what we put together. And Birmingham can definitely take credit from the fact that they didn't allow just a boatload, you know, of chances to Phoenix. It was sort of even, you know, XG kind of falls like 1.0 for Phoenix and a 0.78 for Birmingham. So, I mean, all things considered, even game. And the positions that that Birmingham were getting into against, you know, what is still a very good Phoenix team, I think they can take a lot of heart. Panos, maybe a little lucky at one point, a little bit dramatic in on a penalty shout, and then kind of had it. But overall, on the night, like, loads of quality from the kid. And I mean, once again, you can just see like what a key piece of that Phoenix attack he's going to be. He's a little unlucky actually to not get an assist for a pass that he makes. I think it was first half to Rito, where he just absolutely slices apart Birmingham through no fault of their own. He just finds a keyhole and unlocked them. And so all in all, Phoenix, I think you can definitely see that the plan is there. But Birmingham showing so much resilience on the road at, you know, week one in Phoenix, that's definitely something, a feather in their cap, if you will.
I'm going to go ahead and put a hot take out there. I don't think Marboy makes it through the season without getting bought. I was so impressed.
That's why he went to the USL. Like, I think that's everyone's intention. And you're dead on about how he looked.
Putting himself in the shop window.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, like, I was expecting, I understand week one, and we're probably going to see growing pains throughout the season and be like, this is why he came here as well, is because, you know, he might just be in MLS Next Pro or something like that, where he's playing matches at a lower level and he's just clearly dominating. But also, I was so impressed with what Marboy did. You would not think that was his first ever professional match at all. Couple of officiating things I kind of want to talk about in this. There was a controversial handball moment in the box where a lot of Birmingham fans were saying it was a penalty. A lot of other people were saying it came off a deflection, so it doesn't matter. And then Zapruder film level of goal line technology, was the ball over the line? Was it not? Panos gets, looks like he maybe gets fouled in the box, but nothing comes of it. One that wasn't talked about a lot, Alex Carnale definitely had a professional foul as the last man back, and it was not given as a red. So I think
the distance from the goal is what ends up saving him. And the fact that he's not the goalkeeper, which was a different conversation at the end of last year's USL season, if people can remember. Yeah. Proximity is ultimately what saves him, and the idea that, like, in the, you know, intervening 30 to 40 yards, like, does it someone else have a chance to, like, catch him? Is he truly in on goal at that point? I mean, you might argue yes, because it's like he's absolutely rapid, but I think that's what saves him, is just the distance from the goal.
What I will say is this: Matt Van Okel comes up with like 8 saves, and I don't want to slate him off either, and because 8 saves is crazy. But really, 2 of those were really good saves, and the rest were Phoenix not really testing him. If you were to say, like, good, quote unquote, good saves versus just saves, I think really Matt Van Okel was truly tested twice, which, if you're Phoenix, you're saying, where's the finishing going to come from? Which I think was the question going into this season anyway. I was really happy with the result. I think if you're Phoenix, you probably feel a little hard done by to not come out with at least a point. Like you mentioned, the deflection for Deba that goes into the back of the net. Super fortunate for Birmingham, but they also created stuff along the way. Phoenix probably should have had a goal, but it just didn't happen. Like everybody kind of mentioned, I think both teams kind of leave happy. There's stuff that needs to be fixed on both sides, but also it's week 1/week 0. Like, it matters, but it also kind of doesn't.
Just on the Phoenix and the finishing issue, they're really expecting Remy Cabral to come in and be that number 9, fresh off of his MLS Next Pro Golden Boot, nursing a bit of a preseason injury. So Derek Formella had to fill the role. And Formella is, from what I'm hearing, pretty unhappy to be a number 9. Like, he sees himself as a winger. He sees himself as a number 10. I thought you kind of saw it in the runs he was making. And maybe the passion in the box. So I think that'll only get better for Rising. Kaylee, real quick, how'd you feel about the system, given that it was the debut of the back three for Birmingham?
You can definitely tell that there were some issues in the first half in terms of communication stuff that didn't happen in the friendlies that I went to. Mm-hmm. So clearly Phoenix was providing something that was giving them a different challenge that they were even getting against MLS teams, because Phoenix was creating issues that even some of the MLS squads were not giving them. In general, I think it flowed a lot better. I think that there was a lot more fluidity than there was last year. I think you would have seen a lot more of that on display if Mohamed Boyatore would have just passed the ball to Tyler Pasher a couple times, because there was a couple of times where he had Pasher in one-on-one. And listen, I love Rocco Rios Novo, but there's very few people in the USL I'd like to be one-on-one with less than Tyler Pasher. And so I think you would have seen more fruit from the labor if he had made some of those plays, laid off some of those balls to him. So I think it looks a lot more fluid. I think it looks a lot more together. I think something that John and I, we talked about a couple weeks ago, whenever Legion are in possession, they send the center backs as wide as they go. So the central center back is on the center line, and literally the left and right back are on the touch line. And you could tell that when they got kind of cut in through the channels, because that's where all their chances were coming, were through those channels, because they were as wide as they could be. I think maybe they need to bring it in just a little bit more, and I think it'll fix a lot of problems.
Yeah, fair enough.
On the Pasher thing, like, he probably should have an assist too, because he puts Touré through with an absolutely unreal through ball at one point that he probably should do better with, and he just skews it just wide of the post, I think. So
couple of
moments for Touré, I think, and maybe that was, I think broadly the concern was just like sharpness in front of goal for Legion. So when you don't allow any, you give yourself a pretty good chance on the night. So
true.
Good enough.
Unless anybody has anything else, I would like to stay out west, and I want to talk about New Mexico and Pittsburgh. And I kind of sent this tweet out. Everybody says it whenever Pittsburgh loses 1-0, but Pittsburgh got absolutely lily-balled. Like, absolutely lily-balled. And I really like what Eric Quill has done with New Mexico. Like, really like it.
So, who knows how many expected goals Pittsburgh put up? Anyone?
0.19. I cheated. I was about to say I cheated. Yeah.
0.19.
Oh, my God.
They just couldn't create. So, Phil, you go ahead. But I think
I was going to say all of that was probably in the first about 3 minutes of the game, because off the kickoff, I was like, oh, this is going to be a long season for New Mexico, because they just looked like completely not prepared. Pittsburgh hemmed them in like immediately. I'm just like, man, this could be a long 90 minutes. And then as soon as they got out from underneath those sort of initial kind of flurry of chances, set pieces, that sort of stuff, like in that opening few minutes, they were basically completely in control. And like you said, I don't know if it was a lily ball as much as it was just like they just really exerted their system, like, and they were just proactive, I guess, like in every phase of play. I think the one thing that really impressed me too was just how much of the keys they've given Macaulay Akale. As they have really given him like a lot of influence in the system, which I know, a lot of the questions that I had, being the skeptic, the New Mexico skeptic that I am, like I figured, the question marks are around like, how are these like MLS Next Pro and USL League One attackers going to like gel, integrate, and get to a championship level, because we've just seen this story before. And Akale like looks every bit like the guy who can run that sort of attack and just be that sort of dynamic presence. Marco Micheletto was very good. And then Hurst's finish on the goal was, I think he initially kind of screws it up, right? Like he's trying to drag it past the keeper, but he sorts his feet out really quickly and just sort of improvises the finish, which, you know, there are a lot of forwards in USL who don't finish from that narrow angle. So anyways, yeah, as much as it pains me to have praise for New Mexico, them showing that much, you know, proactivity and really forcing Pittsburgh to play their game, that was an impressive start to the season for New Mexico.
Yeah, I mean, you're looking at a New Mexico team who, I mean, they nearly had equal goals for and conceded last season, and was kind of an enigma towards the end of the year on what was to expect. But to start out the season like they did, kind of going up against the Shield winners last season, and like Kaylor had mentioned, just out Lily Ball and Lily Ball, was an impressive performance. And I had mentioned it in the article I wrote, but I think out of the last 10 seasons, there's only been one time that a team has lost their opening match and had gone on to win the USL Cup. That was 2021 Orange County. So any team, if you can just pick up a result in this first week of games, that is just a massive step forward over everyone else in the league.
So Pittsburgh, if you want to win the championship, you need to fire Bob Lilly and promote somebody within, and you're going to be fine.
I mean, thinking about both teams here, like New Mexico, and Phil, you hit the nail on the head. The way that Akale was able to really drop into the midfield and get touches from what was ostensibly the right wing in a 4-3-3 kind of positioning was great. Micheletto, who I think of as a number 10 or a forward, playing as the deepest lying midfielder, initiating, he was untouchable against what was a pretty fearsome Pittsburgh press. Like, he was never turning over the ball. So lots of good signs there. If you're the Riverhounds against what is a very high energy New Mexico team, certainly, but the lack of offense, the way that you really couldn't get Forbes or Mertz going, was concerning. I think that there was a lot of concern, and rightly so, about losing Arturo Ordóñez and Joey Farrell because of their defensive contributions. But both of them are very gifted at initiating from the back, breaking through the opposing press, whether on the dribble or as a passer. Pittsburgh doesn't have that skill set anymore. So in most of the game, really, their center backs felt very isolated. They were keeping their wing backs really high. The center backs didn't have passing outlets. And it just turned into this cycle where they were constantly having to punt it downfield and not really build up any momentum. I don't know how Lily is going to respond to this. Like, starting Danny Griffin in the back line, who you would have thought had that skill set, didn't do the job. I think he should probably turn to some of the additions like Pierre Cayet and Sean Suber, who were very good passers defensively in Next Pro, and for whatever reason were subbed on his wingbacks late in this game rather than doing the logical thing. But yeah, curious to see how Pittsburgh responds, because Lily does tend to take a couple months to find his lineup anyway, even in the best of times.
See, it's kind of funny, and I'm glad you brought up Griffin, because Danny Griffin was put in as a CDM last year, and he was good enough to do it, but he is a box-to-box midfielder. In fact, I think their only shot on goal was from Danny Griffin in this entire match, I'm pretty sure. So, like, putting him as your center back was wild. Also, kind of feel for DeShields. You're the person that gets yanked off at halftime. Not really being blamed. You can always say, like, you know, he was just tinkering and all that kind of stuff. But if you're DeShields, you're getting yanked off at halftime in the first game. It feels like it's your fault. And then Biasi comes in. I think that's how you pronounce it anyway.
Yes.
And thank you. And he was just okay, even though last year, I'm pretty sure he was the right center back.
Right wing
and
back. He was right, Jamali or right White. Wing back often. Yeah.
Yeah, and he was Jamali White's, like, main guy, and he put him over at left center. Mm. None of it made sense.
And he kept trying to have Biasi play these right-footed switches over to the other sideline. I mean, if he hit one of them, I missed it, because it felt like the most inefficient way to build out possible.
I mean, who's he trying to get it to? Mertz? Because none of it made sense.
Yeah.
None of it made sense.
What I will say, for all the praise that I did heap on New Mexico, the second half of this game was one of the most diabolical 45 minutes of football that I've watched in a long time. Like, it was absolutely awful to watch. And it's not a criticism necessarily of New Mexico, because they didn't have to do anything. And I think that's part of the credit, is they blunted Pittsburgh so like decisively that there just wasn't that much going on in the second half. That being said, I think that, you know, you probably come away Pittsburgh, even after New Mexico dropped off a little bit, and I'm not saying, you know, dropped off quality wise, but literally just physically dropped back a few yards, like pressing wise, like Pittsburgh still wasn't really able to do anything with the extra space. So it, yeah, I think bigger concerns about Pittsburgh and New Mexico, you know, definitely comes away with the positives, but question marks over what sort of test that actually was for New Mexico with how poor Pittsburgh was.
If anybody has anything else on it, I think we're ready to move on. I want to move over to the Miami FC getting a result against Colorado Springs. I don't know what to do with this. I mean, you're looking at, obviously, a 2-0 win in Miami. I don't know. I do, one thing I do appreciate, I've seen it a lot with the Miami FC's account. They fully committed to the Italian bit, so, like, thanks. Thank you for fully committing to just posting things in Italian. I'm all in on that. But is this something, obviously the penalty is what it is. How repeatable is this? Because there's sometimes you see results and you're like, that'll never happen again. How repeatable do you think this is for Miami? And if you're Colorado Springs, is it, hey, week one, it doesn't matter? Or is it like, yo, we have problems we didn't think we're going to have?
I think Miami deserves credit for executing on a game plan. Like, they came out in the world's most basic 4-4-2. They decided we are going to lump it long up to Frank Lopez every single time we build out because Colorado Springs is pressing high and we don't have talented passers in the back. And they got a break. They knew to weaponize on Gavilanes and Ben Mines on the run off of Lopez in a way that was effective enough. They got that penalty, they got the Andrew Booth one from range first because in recovery, Colorado Springs got sucked in. And at that point, you've now got the lead. You're able to sit in the tightest, deepest sitting 4-4-2 you can even imagine for about 70 minutes of the game. Was there an element of luck? Probably. Like, Colorado Springs had 21 shots. They put two of them on target. They had 10 shots within 10 yards of goal. Like, they're going to score in almost any scenario where that happens. But hey, Miami wanted to be defensive. They wanted to counter early, get a goal. They did the job.
The one thing I would say on Colorado Springs in terms of attack is that for the volume of shots that they had, the selection was not always great. And I think they only have like two shots from within the width of the 6-yard box inside the penalty area. So most of their close range shots were coming at these bad angles. And it was a lot of it was a lot of Enriquez from outside the box, or, I mean, Lacroix was like amazing down the line. Like, he was absolutely marauding, which is not typically how I think about him. I think he's, you know, a lot more of a defensive contributor, like, typically, but he was, involved a lot. I just think that there was probably some frustration almost creeping in from Colorado Springs of, they assume that they should be well on top of this game. They probably went in being fairly confident that they quality wise are better on paper than Miami. And it seemed to just like kind of continue to creep in where they started to hit like more and more speculative shots. When you look at how they set up and the areas they were getting into, it's just like, maybe, you know, is there an option for a cutback? Is there an option for a cross maybe here rather than taking on the shot? And then they got, you know, Miami did get the luck in that none of those shots turned into rebounds for easy tap-ins or something like that. So, yeah, it was, I think, you know, if Miami's game plan was limit Colorado Springs to, you know, shots from wide or shots from outside the box, they did kind of do that. And I think nullify, you know, in terms of blunting them, like, Ronaldo Damas doesn't have like a notable chance the whole night. And obviously he is the guy in this Colorado Springs setup, who they're expecting to carry the burden of scoring a lot of the goals. So him not having like a memorable chance is, I think that is at least one thing that Miami can definitely point to and say, like, mission accomplished.
On Domus, real quick, he had two shots. One of them was blocked in the third minute. He didn't get a shoot again for 88 minutes, and then that other chance got blocked. So,
yeah,
I mean, just credit to Miami also, because that's how you do it.
I mean, you mentioned not having a shot from inside the width of the goal, but I mean, that comes down to what John said of that. I mean, it was a hilariously tight and deep back line, like comically so. It looked like what I did on like FIFA whenever I was like finally winning, and I would just set them as close as I possibly could because I was like, I'm not going to concede. That's what they did. Mm-hmm. And they got the efforts of that, because you talk about going up and cutting it back, but if you were to cut it back, they had three defenders sitting on top of the 6-yard box. You can't, there's nothing you can do with that. Miami cannot sustain sitting in deep like that for 70 minutes for the rest of the year, but it's kind of fun that they did it once.
I mean, they're certainly not going to be able to repeat this performance against Sacramento this weekend, I would assume. But like from Colorado Springs' perspective, they had, I think, four players who had multiple shots within the game. It was a fairly even XG battle that even Miami, although they edged out the result, Colorado Springs still contributed to 1.63 XG for this game, 86% passing, over 400 passes in the game. It just didn't come together on that night, and sometimes it's just not your night. But Colorado Springs, I don't think, needs to be hitting the panic button. And at this stage of the season, certainly no one should, but it will come. The results will follow the performance.
Let's go ahead quickly. Let's go back out west, and let's go to El Paso. And Hartford get a result. They get a 1-0 win to Phil's El Paso Locomotive. And I walked away. Obviously, you're impressed with what Hartford did defensively. They looked good. You're probably a little bit disappointed if you're El Paso to not put away chances. But also, these are chances that they weren't really creating all of last year. I walk away feeling more confident in El Paso, but also Hartford looks like they could be real. There is a side of me that's still pretty speculative, though.
Yeah, I mean, I guess on the Locomotive thing, I think it would, you know, I'll focus on them, but it was a tale of two halves. In that first half, it was definitely them getting to grips with the game, and Hartford did not make it easy in terms of the attacking talent, obviously, that they had. And in particular, with that back line gelling, the concession of the penalty is basically a weird sort of space issue between Akinyode and Alfaro that they get into. They have a conversation then. It doesn't happen again, basically, the rest of the 90 minutes. And then Hartford were quick to exploit a very young right side of El Paso's defense with Miles Lyons and Brandon Craig playing on the same side of that back five. And so as Lyons bombed on, like you saw DeShane Beckford exploit that space like time and time. Marcus Epps, they were like getting into that area or playing balls like out into that space for others to run in onto. What I would say is that Hartford did drop off pretty significantly after the first half hour, probably, yeah. Which was interesting because it didn't strike me as very like Burke-esque, I guess, in terms of like not keeping the pressure on, or at least going for a second goal. But they did drop off quite a bit, and Locomotive did find a lot of success. I think it was interesting in how much of the game flowed through Lucas Stauffer, to point out another wingback who really showcased like just how important he's going to be in attack. Mm-hmm. I think, Stauffer was really impressive. He actually, like, you know, per like FotMob ratings and a lot of the metrics and things, was like player of the match for Locomotive, despite he has 5 chances created, which is the most of any player on the pitch, which is pretty wild. And yeah, it wasn't him just like
change sides for the final half hour.
Yeah, he was playing on the left at sort of as an inverted like left wing back, and then switched to the right hand side when Nick Hines came on to play on the right side. And yeah, overall, I think in attack, the one thing that Locomotive fans would certainly have been looking for that they didn't get was the Amando Moreno show in terms of him having some sort of explosive debut. I think he finishes the game with like 19 touches in 74 minutes. And it was clear that Hartford like weren't about to let him like hurt them. And they were pretty focused on that. Jay Chapman and Anderson Asiedu like have a really, really good game in midfield. And I think the one area of the field where I probably have question marks is just the balance in Locomotive's midfield, because Eric Calvillo, Liam Rose, and Tumi Moshibane, who was deployed there despite not really being a traditional eight and looked sort of out of sorts in that role, not really handling like the press in midfield well. The balance seemed off, and it's not good when a midfield two makes your midfield three feel overwhelmed. And that I think is the one area that Clearhout will probably want to sort. In attack, Moreno, they just have to get him more involved. I was really impressed with Justin Dillon and what he was able to do work rate wise. I think he's unlucky as well in that Moreno probably should have had an assist, because the flag goes up when I think Moreno like bends his run and then actually times a run quite well. The goal is flagged for offsides, and it would have been, you know, an equalizer with about half an hour still to play. So it would have, I think the game is like very much in the balance at that point. But yeah, all in all, optimistic night for Locomotive. The one question mark is just in midfield, because when you've got, you know, Eric Calvillo and Liam Rose, who are sort of the two pieces of continuity that you have from last year, when they looked so kind of like imbalanced, that is just the one thing that kind of got my attention in a negative way. But yeah, Lucas Stauffer, that was one that I definitely didn't anticipate pre-match. Like, he's going to be key to the attacking game plan, but it's pretty clear that he's going to be an important piece going forward.
And I guess
go ahead, Brian.
Oh, yeah, like in some solace and like looking at just trends across the entire league, four of the top five teams who produced the most shots in their first game this season all lost. It was only Memphis who got a win that were in the top five highest producing shots of at least this start to the year. So it was still a positive performance. I mean, over nearly 2.5 XG from El Paso, should have something to at least hang your hat on before moving into the next game here midweek.
Yeah. And I mean, speaking of that XG, it kind of just to pivot to the conversation Hartford wise, really didn't look great defensively, especially when the game settled down. It was much less Hartford dictating the tempo through their wingers and much more sitting back and fending El Paso off. Joey Farrell and Thomas Van Kaiseel, I think they won a third of their duel attempts on the night. Like, they just couldn't get anything. I thought Reese Buckmaster was good at right back, but I thought everyone else was somewhat poor. Hartford did miss Marlon Harrison in the defensive midfield. They had to put Jay Chapman there next to Anderson Asiedu. So you're going to get some improvement. They had Paul Walters in net, who was kind of a last minute loanee with little experience. That's going to hurt the communication. I tend to think this team's level lands more in the bucket of where they were early in the match. And I think as they get to know each other and get to know the Burke system more and more, that'll continue to be the case. But definitely some red flags. Like, this wasn't a Hartford team that makes you think, wow, they're going to go do it. They're going to be the best team in the East.
Yeah, that's kind of where I ended up too. I'm glad you mentioned Buckmaster, because I forget how much I like watching him play. He is just really fun. The Williams, Nagalina, you have Chapman, you mentioned. Yeah, Mushkalusa, who ends up coming on. Beckford, Marcus Epps. I mean, it's a lot of players who you like. And I'm excited to see what you do with Burke. It was interesting they mentioned that this wasn't like what we thought of Burke, when, especially when he was at Colorado Springs. Granted, Audrey Berry was there, of, you know, foot on throat, go for the second goal. But also, this team has one of the best defense, or like best back lines and like holding midfields in the league, in my opinion. Like, the pieces that they've built around are really impressive. So I'm not saying that he didn't have this quality of player in Colorado Springs, but I do think that defensively this is a step up from what he had in Colorado Springs. So maybe he could sit on the fact that he could go more defensive and sit on his lead as opposed to Colorado Springs. I mean, goodness gracious, how many 4-3 matches did we watch out of them? And what was that, 2021?
Yeah, I would say, I think in, to John's point, I would say the concern, if I'm a Hartford fan, my one concern would be the fact that between Joey Farrell and Thomas, Van Kazeel. You know, the Dutch man, between the two of them, like, it really was, it ended up being, they, I think they called it a 5-3-2, but with Moreno and Dylan, but it was really a 5-3, like 1-1, and Dylan occupied both of the center backs by himself, which is, that doesn't like fill me with a ton of confidence. If I'm a Hartford fan, thinking like that should have been a mismatch in many ways. Like, and physically, like John was saying, I think Dylan wins 5 out of 7 duels in the air and like 9 out of 13 duels on the ground or something like that. Like, he was winning the ball like constantly and just like fending them off. So I do think there's some question marks in there. That being said, I think Asiedu and Chapman were quite good. And I think they've got all kinds of good pieces. In attack, they're clearly dangerous. They found the space early and like saw where to exploit with Locomotive. So they, you know, they're savvy players. I think, yeah, the question marks for me were once they dropped back, like they were there to be got at, and Locomotive just didn't quite like have the finishing touch on the night.
I do think it is a question with that defensive unit of how much of it is name value and we know these guys because they've been around for a while, and how much of it is they're actually up to do the job in the 2024 USL Championship. So I lean towards like these are good players, but yeah, you never know.
Is it going to be Indy, like,
right,
where we have like a 24
years,
yeah, where we have like a 2019 USL All-Star team that is like, you know, 2 years too late, basically.
For sure. Hey, let's go ahead and go to Greenville, South Carolina, where they ruined the party of the first ever match for Spokane Velocity. And I don't know who it was. Someone can find it for me. But there was somebody in the Greenville fandom that predicted the exact scoreline and how it was going to happen, which was wild. They like replied to a tweet of like predictions. They said, we'll win 3-1 after going down early. It was nuts. So whoever that was, shout out to you. I bet
they didn't have a Zion Scarlett brace. All right, he only got one. Never mind, but still,
yeah, just the one.
I mean, Gio works for the club now, so he could be leaking the scripts, you know.
Gio, please send us the script. We don't ask. Oh my gosh, it's Alan. but listen, with Greenville, I mean, okay, let's start off with Spokane. Spokane looked fun. They looked good. League One was on full League One display at first, and then Greenville kind of just flexed the muscle a little bit. They showed, hey, some of us have been playing professionally for over a decade now. It's obvious that we've been doing that. They have players that have played together for a long time. They were able to flex the muscle on Spokane. Not to say that Spokane didn't play well. In fact, I was very impressed by their first ever match. But I think it's one of those that if you're Spokane, you can walk away and say, you know, we just were not the best team in this one, but we showed a lot of promise. And if you're Greenville, hey, they said it after the match. They heard the noise, which, by the way, I love the fact that players are reading fan-created content. I mean, it just gives that fan-created content much more weight to it. Like, it gives it actual merit. So I love that they're doing that. And I love the fact that it's actual locker room material. I love that for Greenville.
They love that I put them 10th in the table.
I mean,
but no, I think you speaking to the fact that they are returning seven starters who have been there, and some of these guys, especially in defense, have been there forever in Greenville. And they knew immediately that we're going to get behind Derek Waldeck on the break when he's upfield at left back for Spokane. We're going to make sure that we're shutting down Kamarni Smith and showing him into somewhat low percentage shots from long range. I thought they really had a great read on the game. Interesting to see them in a back four. I know that John Harkes tended to be more of a kind of Man City-ish, weird tucked in defenders back three thing oftentimes. I liked it a lot from the Triumph. They're sort of Pittsburgh-ish in that you kind of are a fool if you doubt that they're going to be in the mix just because the scouting is so sustainable. They've got a real idea of how they want to play the game. So good stuff from the Triumph, but not feeling bad if I'm a Spokane guy.
Yeah, I mean, Spokane walked away with this game, producing over 2 XG, and then you had Greenville on the other side, who produced 0.77 XG and managed to get 3 goals out of it. It was a team who scored 3 goals in a match last season at least 5 times. It's Greenville that you know it. It's just the Triumph. They're professional about this. They knew what to do when they conceded early, and they've just been around the block in this league multiple times. Spokane is a lot of fun, and they will have a lot more success as the season goes along. But yeah, it was just a clinical performance from Greenville.
Also, just want to throw it out there, Luis Hill, very good. Luis Hill was very good. I had a very good time watching him again. He's definitely crying out for for Doling to, put away some chances. Obviously, he got his penalty, put it away squarely. But, maybe it's a little bit of a learning curve for, Doling, who never really got his chance. We talked about this one in the League One preview. Having a guy like Luis Hill setting you up, it's almost impossible not to put away your chance if you're even halfway confident. I think once Luis Hill can really unlock the rest of this team, I think they're going to be just fine. That one's going to be fun.
It was also weird, weird like cognitive dissonance for me as an El Paso guy seeing Chapa and Seb Velasquez out on the field for Greenville. So yeah, just one of those cool things to see those guys in League One. Overall, I mean, like everybody said, I think it had very much that first match vibe for Spokane, where they just kind of got done by a team that was more ready for the occasion and more experienced. So
cool. Let's go ahead and move on down to Fuego, which, hey, if you are Fuego and you are looking at Jermaine Jones, you are excited. You get a 2-1 win, which was about this close to being a 2-2 draw. We almost got full-on Tormenta doing what they did last year of conceding just as much as they scored, and it was a lot. We were about to have some fun with that. Didn't end up happening, but we ended up seeing, I don't want to say that the main conversation should be Fuego, because I don't want to take that away, or Tormenta, because I don't want to take that away from Fuego. But Tormenta looked a little bit extra rattled, especially, I hate to say it, but their captain getting sent off in the first game of the year. It's not something that you really want to see out of Tormenta, obviously. But also, Fuego gets, all 3 points. And, look at the fact that you get 2 goals, one's a penalty, one's from super close range. But it also looked I've said this a few times, very repeatable. Everything that they did looked like it could be done again, which is exciting.
So Fuego, game plan-wise, very Miami-ish in that they were bent on playing these long balls, getting the flicks on, trying to cause chaos. The issue was that Their front line was 5'10" Zahir Vasquez, 5'8" Siobhan John Brown, and 5'5" Moe Espinoza. Like, they just had no one who could win an aerial duel. Yet, like 90 seconds into the game, they get the penalty that changes it all. I think the process for Fuego is kind of not repeatable. Like, they don't, the talent, even with some of the additions that they've had, including Espinoza, who signed 90 minutes before the game started and then scored, like, what? Robert Coronado started as the number 10. They hadn't announced him as a player yet. Like, what is happening with Fuego? So I know they got the win. I know that we want to be happy about this team. I'm going to need to prove that it wasn't just a really fluky result, but go off Jermaine Jones. I love that this is just chaos energy.
And Fuego have now won all three of their first games of the season in club history. So it was written.
I gotta stop picking against Fuego ever. I locked Tormenta because I was like, if there's anything that's gonna happen this weekend, it's not Fuego winning. Like, Jermaine Jones is on, you know, he was on Kate Abdo's CBS like couch interview show. While I'm like, dude, you don't have time for this. Like, you got to go sign some players. You got a game in a few hours. Like, and he was
releasing players to sign them.
He's bragging about he fired the whole team. I would remind you, sir, Kudus Lawal is still under contract, and he was on the
bench. He got rid of people he didn't want.
Free Lawal,
who the people's champ is.
Free Kudus. But no, this was like. This is like, how can you not be romantic about lower league soccer? You know, like, this is USL heritage where he's literally phoning up someone to come play in the game. You know, that's like, yeah, we don't get this sort of romantic. USL's become too serious in many ways. So Fuego injects some much needed unseriousness into our lives.
We don't have coaches getting fired at airports and people getting traded for equipment anymore. Bring me back. Take me back.
I think this is a perfect example of like why week one, you'd never really overreact to any win or loss, right? Like, Tormenta's isn't going to win again. And Fuego is not going to win USL League One. Although maybe me saying that means they're going to win League One. But it's just an example of kind of like, maybe week one flukiness, week one jitters, Tormenta maybe not taking Fuego as serious as maybe they should have at the beginning. Because there was a lot of good looks for Fuego at the beginning of the game. And it really kind of, I think the momentum changed toward the end with Tormenta kind of figuring things out. And I mean, the same story with, you know, Spokane is like, let's see where these teams are week 10. Like, hold your horses. Don't get too worried about stuff. You know, you're going to see states of play. You're going to see like, is this how they really play? Or is it because they got an early goal with, you know, talking about like the Miami stuff, because Colorado Springs could get the ball to the attacking third in like a blink of an eye. I think every time we looked up, Colorado Springs was in that final third again. So, you know, it's still pretty early, but again, you know, the initial reactions of the penalty was one that reminds me of how exciting USL could be week in, week out. Of it's not nearly as predictable as one would imagine, and looking at our scores from our picks last week, I think that's pretty obvious that week one is always going to be slightly chaotic, and you get tons of fun out of it.
Speaking of exciting, I wanted to talk about Michael Fuchs. We're saving the most exciting game for last. Which brings up my favorite tweet of the entire year already. Every goal from the Lexington Northern Colorado match.
Signal. We get it, and we're underway. We get
the hype. I mean, in terms of like hype versus the game, like there's not a bigger disparity maybe in the whole USL this weekend, unfortunately for Lexington. I think, you know, we were expecting fireworks and just not to be.
Delgado made an insane save on a Cameron Lancaster free kick. It was legitimate centimeter away from, because he tipped it onto the post. and nobody thought he saved it. He barely tipped it onto the post for it to go out for a corner, I think. And we were about a centimeter away from Cameron Lancaster just did it again, by God. Granted, I also just want to throw out there, when's the last one versus two, the heavyweight battle that actually lives up to the height in any league? Most of the time, it just ends up being a cagey, like, 1-0 win for somebody. Like, usually those big heavyweight battles just aren't the big goal-scoring, you know, punches thrown matches that you think they'll be.
Sacramento Orange County week one was number one versus two, and I would say it was pretty exciting.
Yeah, I mean, goalie goal. I love a goalie goal.
Yeah, Colin Shuttler.
Shout out Colin Shuttler. let's go ahead and let's get into some predictions real fast.
It's a good sign when we're in a full 66 minutes in and we're just getting your predictions.
My fault. Real fast, El Paso versus Louisville. Louisville, who has a bit of their season shaken up with Brian Owenby out for the foreseeable future, lengthy recovery, which could mean anything from half the season till he's not coming back to the playoffs. We don't fully know. El Paso gets another match at home. We talked about that earlier. There's a lot of good stuff there that we think could go well. How much is the OMB loss going to hurt Lou City? Let's go ahead and find out. Ryan, who you got?
I'm backing Louisville to win this one, especially at home, and El Paso coming off a midweek game for some tired legs. But I think Louisville City gets the job done and gets 3 points.
John?
Yeah, I like the look of the revamped Louisville side a lot. I think the tiredness plays a part, so Lou City.
Phil?
I think Locomotive go and get another win at Louisville. I think all things considered, I like the look of it. I'm choosing to be optimistic at the start of the season. Plus, got to find ways to differentiate points-wise. So, looking for my opportunity here.
Early points still matter, Alan.
And that's why I went with a draw. I think maybe this was one that, you know, we've seen a couple of these games already this year where maybe one team is better than the other, but somehow it comes out of the draw, or at least in early doors, as you will. So I'm going to go with draw.
This year is another year of me refusing to pick draws, which I'm sure will not bite me in the end whatsoever. In the middle of the show, full transparency, I changed my mind. I have talked myself into the Locomotive propaganda. Genuinely, the only reason that I think I really switched, because I think it might be a draw, is I want to know how much the OMB injury actually changes things. So I'm going to go with El Paso.
Would you say you're on the El Paso hype train now?
That's the show, everyone. Thank you.
Ryan really went off the rails.
Next up, we have another first ever, super exciting, Rhode Island with their first ever match with friend of the show, Cono Smith, and a former friend of Alan, Coke Vegas, named as the captain for Rhode Island, already sold out to go against this New Mexico side that really caused issues from the defending player's shield. How's it all going to shake up, Ryan?
Rhode Island was pretty much the story of the offseason, especially within the Eastern Conference, for the additions that they made and just being a first-season expansion team. And I feel like they're going to come out of the gates hot. They're going to get a win over a really good New Mexico team coming into this match after getting that week one victory. But Rhode Island wins their home opener.
John?
Yeah, I'm high on New Mexico, but there's something about an expansion team playing their first game in front of the home fans. Gotta go Rhode Island for the win.
Phil?
Rhode Island just announced that it is a sellout for that match already. It's gonna be bumping in Barron Stadium, and I think New Mexico being asked to go do that job against Pittsburgh at home and then immediately go cross country and play an expansion team riding a wave like that, I think it's going to be a big occasion, and I think Rhode Island, has a big party.
I just want to say, after all those terrible jokes, I was really proud of Kaler for just chugging along there.
Oh, no.
Who are you picking?
Rhode Island.
Full steam ahead.
All right. I'm going with New Mexico. I think really it comes down to same thing that we said for Spokane. There are a lot of professionals in this Rhode Island team, but in the end, they've only played together for about a month now. You know, there's a lot of talent with New Mexico that has played together for a while. Also, they regularly play in front of like 9,000 people, so it's not like shell shock that they're playing in front of people. Don't get me wrong, playing in front of your away versus home fans are very different, but I feel like New Mexico has enough to get it done. Speaking of crazy environments, we are about to get Tampa Bay versus San Antonio. Tampa Bay, who always just seems to restock, and this year they brought in a new coach who is just it's just Neil again. And they have a nice
son.
Yeah. So let's see what happens down in Al Lang versus San Antonio, who got absolutely Florian Vallot, by the way. We didn't mention that.
I mean, if you remember this game from last season, it was 3-3 at Toyota Field and featured San Antonio getting a 90th minute equalizer in that one. But I am going to take Tampa Bay in this one to win and get 3 points over San Antonio.
Yeah, like the look of San Antonio's new gameplay quite a bit last week, despite the fact that they kind of blew it at the end. I think Tampa Bay maybe has some things to figure out at the wingback spots and the defensive balance there. So San Antonio going and getting the win.
I am a little bit lower on San Antonio because I'm a hater. And because I think my expectation is that they probably, I know it's a Marcina team, but I feel like they probably should have created more up a man against Loudon for that amount of time. To end the game with only 8 shots just feels like not enough. And I think firepower is ultimately going to undo them in what should be a pretty entertaining game in Al Lang, but Tampa Bay to win.
Alan, do the right thing.
I don't think I'm going to. I think I'm going to pick, or sorry, I'm going to choose San Antonio.
That is the right thing, according to Rob, though. So,
yeah.
No. I think he wants me to not pick them because when I pick them, they don't win. I think that's the bit with the San Antonio fans.
Every time
I pick them to win, they lose, and so they want me to pick Tampa Bay. Although I do enjoy Tampa Bay's references and their kits and all, but I'm gonna go San Antonio.
Quick, change my pick, Ryan. I'm taking San Antonio as well. I liked what I saw. Yeah, hey, guess what? You got Florian Vallot. Guess what? So does everybody in the opening match of the season. It happens to the best of us. I like what I saw at San Antonio. I think it's really put well together. A part of this is I haven't seen Tampa Bay yet this year, and I've seen San Antonio. It's the what do you have versus, you know, what's going to actually happen. Al Lang's going to be bumping, but I'm taking San Antonio. I got to find where our predictions are. Ah, here we go. Lexington versus Chattanooga Red Wolves. Lexington with an absolute thrilling match coming into this one. And Chattanooga, who sneakily had one of the best off seasons in League One. These teams, I think, are a lot closer than I think you would expect based off of the badge. So this one should be really interesting matchup happening in the Bluegrass State.
If we're looking at their three meetings from last season, they had a combined 14 goals between them, and it should hopefully be a more exciting matchup this week if that historical context is any indication. I mean, these two teams combined for 8 goals in their last head-to-head matchup at the end of last season, but I really think this is a match that Lexington kind of needs to come out and like show us a little bit more than they did this previous week. However, that being said, I think Chattanooga is going to get the win here.
I'm all gas, no breaks on the Red Wolves. I love their offseason. I think they're going to be the dark horse in League One this year. Gimme Chattanooga.
I went draw because I wanted to just douse any hype on either side. So I'm overreacting. Lexington, down. Stocks are just tanking right now on Lexington.
Kimmy Lancaster, so. You're done.
So yeah, I'm selling Lexington. I'm selling Chattanooga. It's a draw. I'm doing this as mad money for the rest of the time. I'm just gonna be pacing back and forth here, yelling.
John, I'm a little bit upset that you didn't say all coal, no gas, just to keep that bit going.
Oh, man. This is
right,
so good.
It was right there. It was right there for the taking. I'm going to go with Chattanooga as well, only because John picked Chattanooga. And I know he did a lot of good work diving into USL League One, so I'm going to trust him on this pick.
There we go.
I'm going Lexington, and genuinely, the only reason is that the weather is supposed to be much nicer here in the Southeast, which means there should be a lot more fans at Lexington Stadium. I think that's going to make a big difference of having a bigger home contingency. So I think that's going to be a lot of fun. That said, I do love what Chattanooga did. And if this ends up being another 4-4, I would not be shocked. Or we could end up with another Lexington Noka, which was equally exciting. Last but not least, Central Valley Fuego, I won't even say the people's champion. That's reserved for Loudoun, but they're the people's team, truly, versus Union Omaha, which if there isn't a bigger dichotomy of how teams are run than Union Omaha versus Central Valley Fuego, it's going to be incredible. Welcome home, Jermaine Jones. This should be fun. Ryan, do you think they have a chance?
I mean, Omaha was 3-0 against Fuego last season.
That was before Jermaine. That doesn't count.
It's still Union Omaha, which is one of the class organizations of USO 1, and I still have to back Union Omaha to win this one.
Yep.
Yeah, I've got Omaha locked. Like, sorry if we go, but I think Omaha is exquisitely well run. I think they have a system in place. I think Jermaine Jones is the king of vibes, but it's not going to get the job done.
Yeah, in the battle of Jones versus Casciato, I think Dom is going to take this one. And yeah, I've got Omaha. I am not going to be foolish enough to lock Fuego, so I'm hoping John pays for this a little bit in the back of my mind, because I locked against Fuego last week. But yeah, I think Omaha just they seem to have added some really good pieces despite the losses in the offseason, and I think they'll be very, very strong again this year.
Alan?
Yeah, so yesterday was the greatest holiday in the United States, being 3/11 day, and Nick Hexum being a brand new owner of Union Omaha, I went with Omaha Stiley, and I locked it just because the vibes of 3/11 day, you got to. So I went with Union Omaha Stiley.
Smart. You all have ye of little faith, as the one verse in the Bible said. And as biblical as this match is going to be, you guys are of no faith of album cover Jermaine Jones, which is why I'm taking Union Omaha. So, sorry, Fuego. But that's really that. Just 5 minutes, I will set it up and shut up. The Roots are not being sold the Coliseum because there's a guy named John Fisher who is universally loved in Oakland, has his hands in things, and with his hands being in things, notoriously loved John Fisher teams up with notoriously loved former owner of the Roots, who was disgruntled. Loved entirely as he left to form a new team of the Town FC, who is with Earthquakes too. There's a lot going on here, and I'm just going to let you all discuss it.
I don't think anyone in their life has ever said, I want more San Jose Earthquakes in my life.
I will say to soften the blow of that slightly, I have been to the Aviva, and it is quite a nice day out. But aside from that,
that was really good.
Cade Cowell, he's not there anymore for a reason. So
just the idea that the Town started as this, like, we're independent soccer, we're the voice of the people, and now they're days before the MLS pro season becoming an affiliate, and they're associating with John, like, Fisher, who's just probably the most hated man in the entire Bay Area, I would say. Like, just everything about the optics of this could not be worse. It's baffling. I mean, there's no way this becomes a success. Like, what is the end game for any of the parties involved here? It's bad PR for the Earthquakes. Fisher's going to lose the money that he puts into it. For the people who were associated with the Town previously, it's going against the mission of whatever they were trying to do. It's just ridiculous, frankly.
And I don't think it actually threatens anything that Roots have going on, like, actively. No. It doesn't really begin to touch their operation, which is why it just is just doubly weird. It feels like cutting off their nose to spite their face, sort of, from the Town. And I mean, they're now going to be playing not in town. Like, they have a stadium outside of Oakland. So I just, like, I don't know, the whole thing from a project standpoint, like John said, and I think the tough thing here is, because of the Chattanooga MLS Next Pro stuff, there is a bleed over in terms of Chattanooga fans sort of internalizing some of the hate for this project with the Town towards them from people who follow teams in the USL. And I think it's quite clear that the reasons and rationale and all those things between the two projects are quite different. And we understand what Chattanooga FC's motivations were behind going into MLS Next Pro as an independent team. And we know the actions of the USL that sort of drove that. And you don't have to then hitch your wagon to this crazy sort of, like, ego, like, save or ego sort of, like, project on behalf of a former Roots owner. Like, it's just the whole thing. Like, you don't have to go to bat for them. Like, it's two different things, and we get it. It's fine.
Don't bring nuance into this discussion, Phil.
I'm
glad you brought that up.
I was gonna shout out Dan Creel for the nuance the podcast tweet. Absolutely.
For people who are audio only, Dan Creel, good friend, soccer historian, Nuance, the Lower League Soccer Podcast. Each week we talk about our last episode and how our unwavering beliefs have completely changed due to circumstances we now find ourselves in. Brought to you by the people who have the money to sponsor us this week.
Look, it's a perfect tweet, you might say.
Yeah. here's the thing for me. Forget the soccer wars side of this. The MLS Next Pro, I have fully gone into the boat of I don't care. And I kind of hate to say that, but the moment Rochester died, I realized that this was all fake. Like, none of this is real. The wars, they're real, but also it's kind of not. Especially if you're in Oakland, who they were selling out amateur women's soccer matches with Seoul. And I don't want to disparage women's soccer in the slightest, but, I mean, selling people on amateur women's soccer, I'm seeing it in Birmingham. It's a hard sell for people who are not educated. They were selling it out. Roots do very well for themselves. They've done a great job of making themselves Oakland. I forget the MLS Next Pro side of this because, yeah, Chattanooga fans, you kind of mentioned it. What, you know, they're also having to think about the other side of it, which is not just internalized. They were on the opposite side of it with Red Wolves, right? But I forget all that. They put their name with John Fisher. If you are a person who knows another team's owner, it's never good. If you can tell me the owner of another team, that's not good. Everyone in America, almost everyone in American sports knows John Fisher's name, and that's not a good thing. So not just Oakland seeing John Fisher's name, when the wider scope of American sports sees John Fisher has invested in something, A, all A's fans are thinking he has. B, the rest of Major League Baseball fans are saying he has. What a horrible look.
And you mentioned the fan support that Oakland has. They had 5,100 fans for their opener game last week against Indy 11 and 18,000 fans on Twitter that Oakland sold. They have 4,000 followers on Twitter. Well, the town has like barely over 2,000 fans. And like, I've had this opinion about MLS Next Pro for a reason, but there's a reason why that league doesn't publish their attendance figures, because they know it's going to be poor.
Well, and also because it's developmental. Like this competition shouldn't be the point of MLS Next Pro.
Yeah.
I do want to point out that Oakland Roots does not follow me on Twitter, but the town does. So that again shows you how dumb the town is.
So does that mean this episode was brought to you by John Fisher?
In a way.
Next week we're showing up and we're like, this episode of the USL show is brought to you by Gap. Have you ever wanted Gap for kids? Yeah, we're fine. We got it. Is anybody shop at Gap anymore? Whatever. None of this matters. Anything else on any of this?
I don't know who else is tuning in to, you know, the barnstorming midweek match, El Paso Locomotive, Monterey Bay, tomorrow night.
You know it.
We got the midweeks, so
Phil, right, you need to convince me not to bet on that one.
Honestly,
this is the season where Ryan becomes a degenerate on the show before our eyes.
Hey, I have a lot of bonus bets right now through Bet365, and I need to use it by Sunday, so I need to start finding random things to bet on.
DraftKings said it was a no sweat bet, man. I don't know. Oh man, time to sponsor the show and talk about why Bundesliga 2 is the best league in the world. Slander, have you not seen the kit?
Second only to the USL.
Exactly.
A kit that I just received this week.
Very true. It's always nice to see that come around. So final thoughts for the night. Alan, we haven't heard much from you, so I want to hear from you.
Yeah, I want to shout out Peter Bloom for his beautiful text or his beautiful tweet in response to Sacramento calling themselves indomitable again. His tweet was set piece defense, however, extremely dominable. And I thought that was just absolutely perfect. So I want to give him a shout out at Peter W. Bloom. He blogs about Oakland.
Yeah, he's the man.
Yeah, that was. I giggled way too much at that. So that was kind of, that's my final thought of the night. Just shouting out and some more content creators tweeting hilarious things about USL.
Which I don't want this to become a segment that I diverge too much. I hate the updated crest. They got rid of the indomitable part of the crest and the bear looks worse. I hate it.
Well, they made it gray silver instead of the nice tan color. It's objectively worse if you ask me.
I mean, they lose one time at home and they're no longer indomitable, which is wild. I don't know. Phil?
I guess I'm... Well, I saw Dune like everybody else, so that's like literally been occupying so much of my brain recently. I literally all of the match day memes about El Paso Locomotive's home opener were all like me and John got in like a meme war of dude memes. If you haven't, okay, if genuinely, if you're listening to this and you haven't retweeted John's reply to me where he put Bob Lilly on Vladimir Harkonnen, like floating in the air, then you have to like.
I think it's the most disrespectful thing I've ever put on Twitter.
I couldn't believe you actually put it there. But yeah, no, that was, so I've got that, that I've been watching and then, Shogun, I'm like fully in, although I am I think my take on that was like, why'd they go all in on this white guy for like the Japan show? And then the last thing is that the F1 season started back up and my team is like objectively the worst. They have the worst car. They were, you know, hoping to be back like a little bit higher than like fifth, sixth place out of 10, and they dropped like a stud. They designed the worst car in the whole, you know, grid. So it's going to be a suffering season for that. And I've just been shouting about, you know, Premier League refereeing for the last, you know, 5 days or whatever since, well, it feels like it's been 5 days. It's been three. So anyways.
John?
Yeah. Daylight savings hit me like a brick. Like, it's never been this bad as it has this time around, so not loving that. Yeah, I guess I'm going to just second the Shogun shout. I caught up with it finally, loving the show, super cool and interesting. Really kind of dense with the politics and lore of it in a way that is super fun and appeals to a certain kind of person, so go watch Shogun on FX.
Ryan?
Yeah, I mean, I'll third the shock for Shogun as well. It made me, like, at the end of the third episode, it made me just think, I was like, I want more of this. And why do I have to wait a week for this? Because I was a person who watched Game of Thrones well after the show had ended. And I was like, okay, I can just burn through all these episodes one after another. And then with this, I'm like, oh, wait, no, I have to wait another week for it. And so definitely go check out Shogun. And then I guess another random thing. I got a soccer card of Nico Schlotter back, the Dortmund center back, an autograph card randomly from one of the shops here in Charlotte for just $5. So that was a neat addition to the collection. It goes alongside my Dane Scarlett autograph card.
Just the best.
That was a name I wasn't expecting to hear tonight. Let's see. I will not be shouting out Shogun. I refuse to do it now. No reason why. Where can I even watch Dune? I have no idea.
The movie theater.
But isn't there two?
The first one is on Netflix.
First Dune is on, like, they lent it to Netflix for a month. It's on Hulu this month. They're really trying to get people to watch it. So, like, it's probably on something you have.
Yeah. You could also speed read the book. That's 800 pages.
I'm just going to watch Star Wars Episode 4 again and pretend I saw Dune. Is that okay?
I mean, it borrowed enough elements.
Yeah.
It's weird 70s sci-fi where stuff sort of just happens for the first, like, you know, the first few scenes where you're like,
robots walking around in the desert.
This is happening now.
Just guys being dudes. let's see. I kind of got nothing. Last week, the reason we had to delay for like a week, basically my band had to go through assessment, like performance assessment stuff, and they ended up doing really, really well, which was really exciting. But I also, with next week being the school spring break and the assessment over with, I have no idea what I'm working for right now. I am like just killing time to just survive. But hey, that's okay, because I'm sure I will find something to do while definitely working and lesson planning and totally not looking up stupid USL stuff. So there's that. I don't think there's anything else for the night. Appreciate you all listening to an hour and a half. This is great. Thank you all so much and all the love that we've been getting recently. And for the last time tonight, because, hey, we did get a first time tonight, here's Alan's voice.
Thank you for watching another episode of the USL Show. The USL Show is now proudly part of the Protagonist podcast family. Please go to protagonistsoccer.com to check out more work. Thanks for stopping by. We'll see everyone again next time.